The Movie Morgue podcast is supported by our listeners, patrons, and friends. If you want to learn how to support our show, please go to patreon.com/doubledocmd. The content and discussion in this week's episode is centered around issues of addiction, mental illness, sex work, and trauma. Now, we do our best to engage with difficult material thoughtfully and empathetically, but if this material just isn't for you, please feel free to skip this episode. We'll catch you next week. Just wash it all, wash it
all away, it will haunt you. Ladies and gentlemen, and Jared Leto, and of course, all other addicts of all other stripes, welcome to the Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, animator at large, Silvio Emery.
And I am visual culture scholar, Annie Neller.
And joining us today is a new guest, new friend of the show. How do I say this? Aggressively horny shit poster and Kamen Rider aficionado, Arthur Lay.
Hello, everyone. No one should ever watch Wizard or Ghost. It is a plague upon your houses.
You know what? That is fair. And today we are going to be covering the 2000 Darren Aronofsky tragedy porn, I think yes. Is a good way to describe it. Requiem for a Dream. Yeah. Da-na-na-na, da-na-na-na. Okay, that's enough of that.
That hasn't been infecting. Not Lux Eterno.
Yeah, that totally hasn't been infecting movie trailers for the past 18 years. No, sir.
Oh yeah, no.
So yeah, let's talk a little bit about context here. So Arthur, if you want to start us off, because we asked you for what movie you wanted to do with us, and this was the first thing that popped into your head. So what is this movie to you, and why were you so excited to talk about it?
Well, all right, to say what this movie is to me, we have to delve into some backstory. So I first heard about this movie about 10 years ago when I was much younger and much more depressed. So one day, I was just kind of complaining to one of my friends, and he's like, "Hey, man. You know what? You should watch this movie, Requiem for a Dream. It's really fucking cool. And the best thing is, it has this ass-to-ass scene." And I'm like, what the hell? This is not like a thing that goes on like American movies. It's fuck you. Fuck you. So then I just drop it for like several weeks until he reminds me of it again. It's like, dude, this ass-to-ass scene is really good. So I just shrug and decide to go for it. So at this point, I am still massively, enormously depressed. So I boot up the movie, I watch it sincerely, and I cry during it. And I cry at the end. And, you know, it just kind of stuck inside my head as the movie that I went into for ass to ass and went out of it liking everything but the ass to ass.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, that is my elevator pitch for this movie is, quote from Darren Aronofsky, 2000, "You will have a boner and you will hate yourself." But yeah, Annie, do you have any personal context for this movie?
I actually don't, and this is my first time seeing this. I found out probably in the first 5 minutes of the film that I had this confused with Seven for a long time. So this was a new one for me. And yeah, I had no context.
All right.
That's how it goes.
So for me, this is a movie I watched back in high school. I remember this is probably my first attempt to really breach into broader film literacy, because a lot of people were like, you know, this made so many like internet top 10 lists and so on. It's like, the most harp, whatever. And, yeah, I remember being absolutely devastated by it. Like, this was one of the first difficult movies I had to watch. And actually, I want to talk briefly about the broader context of Darren Aronofsky's work for a second, because I was kind of trepidatious about approaching this movie, because Aronofsky's recent output has not been stellar. And more to that, in the intervening years, I've learned a lot more about kind of his relationship with the work of Satoshi Kon. And yeah. I was worried, honestly, that there wouldn't be any substance to this and that it would have just been, you know, oh, you were a kid, so you were stupid, so you didn't understand that it was actually a hack movie. And I'm pleased to say that it's not, but that was a little bit of context for my kind of mindset going into this viewing. That being said, before this, I don't think I've seen this in probably over 10 years. So, yeah, I probably saw this when I was about 14 or 15, if I had to put a number on it.
Oh, no. Damn. Oh, no. This would have just, like, destroyed Baby Doc. Oh, that's so sad.
Baby Doc, directed by Edgar Wright. Pretty please. Just me aggressively shitposting on the internet with all the keyboard types just synced up to music. It'll be great.
Yeah, that sounds like a movie I'm never going to watch at least twice.
So let's get to the review portion. Let's kind of talk about how we thought about this movie. So Annie, I actually want you to start first then because this is your first time seeing this.
Oh no. I feel like this keeps happening on the podcast where I've never seen something before, but I think a lot of times we're just watching stuff that's outside my usual, I don't know, grazing grounds, I guess I'll say.
Quit dodging the question.
You know, I'm going to have to give this an A. I think that it's a deeply disturbing film, not just about addiction, but what people were going through at the turn of the century. And that was just really depressing, and this was kind of the idea of here's what's happening now. I think there are some great performances in this movie. I think ultimately there are some very serious issues with shock and awe filmmaking in terms of that, but we can talk about that a little bit later. How about you all? Where would you all place this?
All right, so I would probably just give this an A also, but I also come from this from a point of not being extremely huge on film or film crit, so shrug. Anyways,
I really
do like genuinely appreciate all of this movie's like horrible bits, and I think my favorite character is actually Sarah Goldfarb.
Yeah, same.
No, yeah. That is one thing I think is actually kind of fascinating about this is who we relate to in these films changes over time. Because there was a lot of depth. There's a lot going on in this movie, and we'll come back to that. As for me, I'm definitely putting it in the A category. What I used to describe this movie as back in the day when I first saw it and kind of how I've had it indexed in my mind for a long time is this is a masterpiece of film, and by which I mean I hate it and I never want to watch it again. And that mostly holds true.
See, yes? in my head, I view this as a movie with a hard sell on replay value.
Also accurate, though.
Yes. Yeah. But to come back to my review is I'm definitely putting this in the A. I'm considering, honestly, an A+, but from a modern audience perspective and with a little bit of just kind of baggage and how things have aged, it's going to prevent me from putting into A+. Just from a little bit of, I think, kind of Seinfeld affecting.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Which, I hate to do it, but like some of this has aged very, very well, and some of this is kind of like, this is kind of boilerplate now, but I have to recognize the law. This was kind of new and exciting at the time. And there's still like a cohesive kind of narrative and directorial thrust that I really respect. So I'm going to stick that solidly in the A section. So now let's get to mechanics because I want to see how this film does what it does. And the first thing that I want to talk about is these split camera segments, because those are fucking brilliant. And I don't think we've seen anything kind of on this level of use of that since, I mean, basically until Drive.
Yeah, that's accurate. I think one of the things that I noticed about those split sequences was that I really viscerally hated them, but they work so well. And I think the reason why I hated them, I'm thinking of the one where Jared Leto's character and Marion are like touching faces and it's like caressing and we've got close-ups and it's just kind of jarring and a strange way to shoot that scene. And I found that kind of like frustrating as a viewer, but also interesting, I guess.
Actually, one thing I really liked about that sequence, just for a moment, is, I mean, it was very intimate, but also there were some kind of subtleties that I think raised the intimacy and kind of disjointedness of that scene. In particular, how close the camera is, of course, but also how close the camera is while still maintaining recognizability, even if it's very subtle, or I guess you'd call it subliminal, because one of the shots I recognized, it was a finger tracing a palm, and you could only really recognize it from the lines of the palm. And I think if you weren't looking for it, you would subconsciously recognize it, but you would look at that and go, there's a finger on a palm. You just go like, I recognize what that is, but I don't process it, you know? And so that felt very like, I mean, like, I'm overusing intimate, but that is, I think, the entire thrust of that scene.
No, that scene is extremely intimate. Like, you can't really escape the intimacy of it. They're just, you know, kind of laying on the bed with each other.
So what are some? I think rather than describing scenes or shots, even in this film, although I think we do want to talk about some of those at some point. I think what might be kind of a good place to start for us is looking at, I think, elements of this film, kind of where I started. Because there's a lot of things that come back time and again, and things that are more techniques for the storytelling of this film rather than... Because the narrative of this film is actually quite simple and kind of straightforward. And I think actually in some ways kind of unsatisfying, which I guess is the, you know, artistic intent of it.
Well, it's because it's a postmodernist film, right? And I'm not just saying that to be bougie. that's quite literally what this is. It's pushing back against the sort of established ways of telling stories that were part of modernism. This idea that narratives need to have a beginning, a middle, an end, that time needs to progress in a linear fashion, that the narrator needs to be reliable, that there are clearly identifiable protagonists and antagonists, and, you know, good and bad people, and we don't empathize with the bad people, we empathize with the good people. There's the abject, and then there is us. And this film throws all of that into chaos because it's a very human story that it's telling. It's a story that's relatable to, I think, a lot of folks. Even if there are some problems with the film itself, it's talking about addiction. And that's a very familiar story, but it's also one that requires filmmaking techniques that help the filmmaker to simulate psychological fracture. So split screen, intimacy that is so close it's jarring, and, you know, that sense of time that we get that's distorted, that's kind of out of, I don't know, out of whack, out of sync, that's definitely something that comes through in a lot of narratives about addiction, and for anyone who's experienced addiction, it may certainly resonate.
So kind of related to this, I have two things I want to say. One, as the movie goes on, you start being unable... what happens in the movie, I notice as time goes on, is that as the characters kind of slide deeper and deeper into their addictions, time starts to stop actually being able to be distinguished from one day to the next or one week to the next or etc.
Yeah, it gets easier.
It gets hazier and it gets a lot jumpier. Like,
yeah.
Also, the second thing I want to talk about is, I like how as the movie goes on, the infomercial steadily progresses. We always get the same loop-ish of time in the infomercial, but as the movie goes on, the infomercial just continues along further and further back down into it until we finally get the entire infomercial. And it's always just that same stupid self-help thing.
Yeah. I actually have a weird comparison because this is one of those techniques that I think was really kind of groundbreaking at the time and has now been like added to the lexicon of film.
Used to death.
But I think the most like succinct way I can describe this technique is the dead space effect. Because in the intro of the video game Dead Space from Insomniac Games, you are shown a video clip of the damsel in distress. I think it's your wife or something. It's been a while since I played that game, but you see a distress beacon from her. There's video footage and so on. And spoilers for Dead Space, a game that came out like 10 fucking years ago. Get over it. But you get to that point, and by the end of the game, you get to, and that footage is played multiple times throughout the game. And at the end of it, you see that the footage actually reveals that she died from the very beginning, so that you've always been crazy. And it's that technique of taking a section of something that the characters see or some past information and drip feeding it to the audience to recontextualize things. So that's something that's
the unreliable narrator.
Yeah, it's an unreliable narrator thing, but it's a distinct form of it.
Yeah. Okay.
Particularly when it's something that is footage and not a literal flashback. So yes, to bring video games into our very serious film literary criticism podcast.
I mean, we're so profesh.
Oh, absolutely.
So profesh.
I think by saying the word profesh, we are automatically unprofesh.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, good. Profesh. There we go. That'll give us
We are very professional before this, though. But it's dead now.
Yeah. So, yeah. So what are some other... Okay, so let's talk about this for a moment, because I actually really fucking love Christopher McDonald in this. He's actually a surprisingly powerful piece of this. And when he becomes... And that's like another thing. Like, there's so much about... This movie came out in 2000. And this movie is 18 years old now. And that kind of blows my mind, because that's kind of... This is literally turn of the millennium.
Yeah, it's literally turn of the century, and I found it oddly predictive in some ways when I was thinking about it earlier. Like, its address of people needing to be visible to the public in order to feel like they exist is so much a part of our lives now because of social media.
Yeah, definitely. But one of the things I noticed is that in a weird way, this film today feels kind of historical. Because with the way that our kind of social landscape has evolved and the way technology has kind of exploded into things in the last decade and before that even. Because, like, you know, I've been on the internet since, like, 97 or so. But, like, it wasn't a widespread thing back then. But now, you know, everyone and their grandpa has an iPhone. So thanks, Steve Jobs, for ruining the internet. But...
Oh, yeah. And if you add an iPhone into this movie, what you get is an episode of Black Mirror.
Exactly.
Like...
But...
Yeah.
In a way, it's weird because I'd say this movie is closer to the 70s than it is to today.
Cinematically?
Not cinematic. Well... There are certainly some cinematography. Because
I could see that.
But more specifically, kind of in looking at the people they're portraying and the kinds of lives they're living, is this is a pre-digital film.
Okay.
And we got to remember, this is you know, of an era with, you know, Star Wars The Phantom Menace.
Yes, these two movies came out the same year, actually.
Actually, I thought Phantom Menace was 99.
Yeah, actually, you might be right about that. I think it was, like, a couple months before.
So,
but within, like, 6 months of each other.
Yeah, weird. So, you know, we're looking at the time right around the beginning of the prequel era. We're looking at what time it was all filled. So I think, and I guess this is kind of broaching into deep cuts, which I'm fine with because there's a lot to talk about in this film. But... this is kind of a film that I think ends with millennials. weirdly enough. Because this is not our lives. This is you. We're all what around? Knock. How old are you? Sorry, Arthur.
I'm 28.
Yeah, 28, 27. That's us about here. So we are actually the exact ages of the actors in a lot of this. Weirdly enough, Jennifer Connelly is like 1 year older than Jared Leto. So they were about 27, 28 as this film was going on. But to say that, and feel free to disagree with me here, and I actually really appreciate if you do, but this is not our lives. This is not the lives of us, but this is the lives of people as we remember it when we were children. And so for, I think, you know, Gen Z onwards, like, this is, as young as these characters are, as, you know, youthful as the energy of it is, this is like going back and watching a historical film. This is not a life that is necessarily relatable to kind of our formulation of what life is anymore.
That's really interesting that you say that, because I actually found the opposite to be true, so I'm going to disagree with
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely, please do.
I found this movie and the characters in it to be completely relatable in so many weird ways. And it's not just, like, well, let me preface that. There's a specific historical context in which to understand these characters and what's going on. But I think that the narrative lives on beyond that because it's about addiction. And so it does have certain ways of speaking to things that are a part of our life now. And then on top of that, it makes some really salient commentary on aging and not just the beauty industry, but the kinds of everyday things that we say that reinforce certain ideas about women and aging. That was just super relevant. The other thing that I was thinking of was the scene with Tyrone's character where he's sitting in a waiting room and he looks behind him and there are these two white guys kind of like staring at him and then a cop appears in front of him. That was oddly relevant as well. And there are just a lot of things in this movie that I think we could easily say are from a previous generation, and yet in so many ways, a lot of the situations that I see in this film are very relevant to right now. Even the idea of people who can't name addiction as addiction, like, that's...
I can see that.
Yeah. Was that not what you meant, though?
Yeah. But one thing I will kind of say to that, and I think when I'm saying that this feels like a historical film, I'm not trying to say that it isn't relatable or anything, but what I do feel is that one of the things I have in my notes here is this film, I think, is in many ways about isolation and kind of loneliness, and what that looks like today is very different from what that looks like 20 years ago. And this is a pre-information film. And, like, I think if you were to make this movie today, there would be something about, you know, like, I think Sarah Goldfarb is a very important character in this film, specifically because she is connected and connected very superficially to the people around her. She's connected very superficially to the world via her television set, and it's not fulfilling and it doesn't give her, you know, self-actualization or self, you know, importance or worth. And so, like, to remake this film today, that would have to be some kind of, I think, more hackneyed Facebook or YouTube metaphor.
It would be an Instagram diet tea account that she would be looking at. It would be the Instagram posts under the hashtag about, like, fit bodies and stuff. Exactly. So that's also the thing that I'm thinking, is that these are updates to it and not necessarily, I don't know. I think there's a different context when you show it today, but yeah, it still addresses that. Like, she's still staring at the
screen. I'm not saying that anything about this is really unrelatable, but I think the further we go into time, and basically starting with people who were born, you know, 5 to 10 years after us,
yeah,
this is a film about problems we still face today, but this is going to be, for them, I think, a film about how your parents dealt with shit like that.
Yeah. Okay, now I see your point a bit more. Yeah.
I also have one thing I want to put forward about this movie. It has everything to do with what you two said, but it's also about the dangers of essentially escapism, where you escape and you don't really consider the people around you, where you're just alone, basically. Because you notice at the end, I can do spoilers, right?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of So at the end. At the end, Sarah has gone through electroshock therapy, and she is just done. She is just lying on the bed and thinking about the game, thinking about that self-help game show constantly. Marion is miserable because, you know, the ass-to-ass thing, and the fact that she has to work for Big Tim. Harry is just, he's missing an arm entirely now. But Tyrone is different from the other three in that, at the end, he's still thinking about living up to the idea of successfully growing up and his mother, basically. Like his scene, Tyrone's scene ends with him thinking about his mother and thinking about how he should, like, presumably live up to the fact that he wants to do right by her.
Yeah, there's a lot going on with Tyrone. And actually, let's go back to performances for a moment, because that is something that we like to talk about, is Marlon Wayans has some fucking dramatic chops. Like, this is not something I expect. I did not remember that this was a Wayans brother at all.
Yeah, and a lot of people commented on that when the film first came out. They were like, you know, Wayans is in this, but he's also making these, you know, very, like, They're called lowbrow comedies. That's usually what they get billed under, which has its own value of judgment built into it. And so the idea was like, oh, he can actually act, so why does he have to do that other stuff? Which I think is kind of a major slight to him, because doing comedy is...
Hey, comedy's hard.
Yeah, it's hard. And he's so vulnerable in this movie. He puts so much into this character. Like, the way that he uses humor in this role is so different from the other roles. Here, it's at times a coping mechanism, but also at other times it's just about being incredulous in the moment of things that are asked of him by Harry. Because Harry asks him to do a lot of stuff that would put him in danger.
Yeah. The other thing also is he... And this is more of a thematic examination than anything reflecting his performance necessarily, but he is also arguably, I think, probably the most sympathetic character, perhaps, in certain ways. But also, he is, I think, the most blameless of any of them.
Yeah.
And so, it's kind of an interesting contrast because a lot of his arc has to do with the carceral state and crime and, you know, the African-American experience. But also, he is, in so many shots and in so many ways in this film, indicated and kind of painted, you know, as a child, as a babe, as being innocent. He is the only character, really, we see, like, you know, I think, naked in a non-sexual context, for example. I mean, yes, his girlfriend is on the bed waiting for him, but he's just standing there looking at the mirror. Yeah, I think he's the only one who fucks without drugs as well.
Yeah, which is also interesting.
I believe so, yeah.
And I think that scene in particular is one of the only ones where both of their bodies are shown together in the same shot. Like, it's not fractured through split screen or just a flash on the screen like it is in that end scene.
Oh, I didn't notice that, actually, but now you say it, I can really see it in my head. Huh.
Yeah. It's interesting because the way he processes memory in this film is, I think, very different to how a lot of other people do. Because one of the things that was revolutionary about this film and that's kind of been disseminated and hacked up into the rest of film going forwards, is I think what's really iconic about this film is the drug shooting sequences as just these quick jabs of practical thing, sensation, description, reaction, these quick sub-second shots and sequences. This is something that has been adopted into the lexicon of film, but was really striking in this film. But that is how a lot of this film is perceived, is you have characters, you have things that they remember or things that they are experiencing, and they're fragmented. They're little shots. Like I said, the touch of the finger along the palm is its sensations, it's these... And it feels very organic, and it feels very true to how we remember things, because brains are weird. But for Tyrone, the way he seems to process the world is as images, as pictures, kind of, you know, like photos on the wall. So you have him cuddling up with his mother. You have him having sex with his girlfriend. And that, like, beautiful rotating shot. As opposed to Harry and Marion, who are, like, just junked out and very incoherent.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other character that you could look at if you wanted to talk about a relationship to image and seeing things through the image would be Ellen. But Ellen sees through a distorted image. And I think it's a bit different because it's the image that she sees in the television has kind of like warped her on a soul level, on a mental level. Whereas Tyrone's image that he has of his mother, while it's idealized for certain, it's this important emotional moment in which she tells him that it doesn't really matter what he does in life. He has inherent value as a person.
And one last thing before we move on from Marlon Wayans is just the shot where he's staring at the mirror is just haunting.
Yeah.
I just want to say that, put that out there, because genuinely, it is such a moment of quiet in what is otherwise a very frenetic and chaotic film.
Yeah.
So going back to performances, I actually like Jared Leto in this one. I don't know about you guys.
I mean, I was really surprised when I saw his name in the credits, and I didn't know, like, I don't know Jared Leto by face. So when I saw him in the credits, I just kept looking for him, but not being able to find him. So I'm just like, who the fuck in this movie is Jared Leto? So when the credits finally came in, I was like, okay, this is Jared Leto. Okay, I like this performance, and he doesn't seem like a miserable asshole. He's genuine, like, charming, charismatic. He's good.
Yeah, he's got a real, like, early Jake Gyllenhaal vibe, which I dig. And this is also before, you know, 30 Seconds to Mars, and before he really took off, and also before he became a bit of a sex pest. So there's a degree of... Yeah, he's a sex pest. At least, allegedly. Allegedly. Allegedly!
Thank you from the legal department.
I was contesting a bit.
Yes.
The legal department kissed my ass. Please don't put that on the record. And let's go on.
It's too late. Everything is on the record. But did you guys have any thoughts kind of on his performance?
I don't know how I feel about Jared Leto's performance in this. Like, there are some scenes where I'm like, wow, you are really doing stuff here. But I also know that in researching for this role, he would go and sit out with addicts and inject himself with water and sit with them and study how they reacted to things to kind of learn how to play this role. And I don't really know what I think of that. There's something in there feels unethical to me, and yeah, I don't...
It feels gross. It feels touristy as fuck and weird, now that you say it. Now that I know this. It's just odd.
And, you know, it may have helped him to create what he felt was a more authentic performance in this film. Because I will say, you know, like, the scenes where he's interacting with his mom work really well for me. Him kind of like coming back from the drug run that goes bad worked for me really well. But yeah, I kind of don't know what to do with him. I'm sort of torn.
Yeah, there is a lot going on, and I can definitely see the touristy thing going on. This is another thing I think that goes back to part of why I think also we're going to have a different emotional context for this and a different relatability to this going forwards as, you know, generations of people, is because the other way that this film has kind of lived on my mind is this is the film that Dare should show kids. Because,
yeah.
Like, that's something that kind of doesn't go away, but, like, it's a it's an attitude from a set piece of time from when we were kids.
Yeah.
That has dramatically changed today. And that is one thing that I found I actually really did not enjoy about this film,
mm-hmm.
is there's a, I guess you'd call it a pathologization. That's one of those words that you don't use a lot. It's a pathologization of addiction that I think definitely feels a little bit preachy and a little bit judgmental. And I think in the eye of the camera, while it is sympathetic, ultimately it does kind of judge and condemn these characters for their addictions.
Yeah, I think the one thing that this is doing that was a little bit new for, like, the late 90s, early 2000s, was juxtaposing this kind of addiction to dieting, especially with older folks, with a very serious drug addiction. Because they're, and I'm not quite sure of this, but are they using meth or heroin?
It's speed.
Okay.
She is definitely on.
She's on amphetamines, speed. But yeah. And I think by juxtaposing those two particular forms of addiction in the film, it's suggesting that they have certain forms of parity, right? Like they're, in certain ways, they're related. They're similar. And I think that is new for that period, at least.
So I just realized something right now. You can draw a line from Sarah Goldfarb's and being prescribed amphetamines, meth, speed, whatever, directly to the opioid epidemic that's going on, because she was prescribed to it. She was prescribed it by a very casual doctor.
Well, yeah, I mean the guy doesn't even look at her, which I think that's actually one of the reasons why I like Ellen Burstyn's performance. Out of everyone else's performance, and I know that's very subjective, but whatever. It's because of those scenes where she's interacting with the doctor. Like, this movie makes a very definitive statement about the healthcare system and the way that it treats people, and what that means for the way that people live their lives or whether they'll be able to. And that's actually kind of interesting for the time as well.
Yeah. And there's a lot of weird intersections, I think, in how she is treated by society. First of all, Annie, feel free to jump down my throat at any point during this next bit. But the way that doctors treat women, there's a lot of problems going on with there, mainly because 99% of the literature is written by and for men. There's things like, there's a lot of different, what am I looking at? Not PCOS, but there's another syndrome. It's like, help me out here. There's like a syndrome where it's like no known cause, pain for the rest of your life, nothing we can do about it.
Huh.
Like, there's so many things where it's like, oh, you're a woman, so I don't know or, frankly, care to actually research and try to help you with this. It's just take some fucking pills. So there's the intersection of kind of the neglect and disregard towards women in medicine, but also towards the elderly and also there's a kind of the predatory nature of pharmaceuticals. One thing I thought was kind of interesting is that she is brought in kind of by a predatory phone call. You know, you've already won. There's a lot of telemarketing technique there. Is no, we're not trying to sell anything to you. It's not, you know, you can own your own business. It's not a job. You're not buying product. You're buying inventory. There's a lot of that soft, euphemistic language and I guess what you'd call diffusing technique in rhetoric. And that's what brings her, that's what starts her on the spiral. That's the first domino. And that is something, you know, phone fraud against elderly people is a real problem. I've heard a lot of horror stories. And so, like, there's a parallel, I think, to kind of how pharmaceuticals are advertised today. You know, ask your doctor about da 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 da. Because, you know, fucking, like, you know, there's doctors who get kickbacks and prescribing shit. They're, you know, you can't legally tell doctors to prescribe this to their patients, but you can tell patients to ask about it and so on and so forth. Is, like, that's, I think, surprisingly relevant today. But there's, like I said, there's a lot of intersections of what makes Sarah Goldfarb's plight very, and the way she's treated, particularly in the medical context, to be, you know, horrifying, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Especially some of the scenes towards the end where they're using electroshock therapy, which is still, in the U.S., used as a legitimate form of therapy. That was a really interesting scene for me, too, because, you know, essentially she's been ignored by her doctors. She's been prescribed these medications, and they have made her severely, severely mentally ill, on top of her already pre-existing issues. And what do they do with her when she's in the system? When she gets carted in, they immediately say, there's nothing wrong with this one. She goes to psych. And then, I mean, she ends up mostly vegetative at the end of the film. Like, it's a compelling portrayal of what happens to elderly people when they enter the healthcare system a lot of times. So, yeah, I liked that. There's a lot that I like about Ellen Burstyn's portrayal of Sarah, though, so.
Yeah. There's also some stuff in there, I think, about kind of the dehumanization of mental health patients. But also, there's something really chilling about the way the orderlies or the nurses, I'm not sure what, the medical technicians, I guess you might also call them, and how they casually discuss whatever fucking shit's going on in their day as they're doing these, I guess you, I wouldn't call them non-medical, but these basically very callous and abusive actions towards someone whose input they basically have been given sanction to completely ignore.
Oh, relatedly, I do very sarcastically love when the doctor, the main doctor overseeing her, gets her to sign a form that I'm pretty sure she doesn't even know is actually there. And she's just kind of automatically doing something. It's very, this is very much a violation of every sense of ethics ever.
Yeah, that's fucked up. Informed consent, buddy. Informed fucking consent.
Basically, Sarah Goldfarb's story of her... Basically, Sarah Goldfarb's entire story is doctors not caring and doctors kind of, like, ignoring her as a person entirely and just kind of fobbing her off on with whatever until it gets to a point where they have to do something, then they disregard her, then they continue to disregard her as a person entirely because, you know, she's crazy. Just shrug.
Which is really just kind of like, again, with this film, I found that oddly prescient, not just of how the healthcare system works in the 2000s, but also how mental health care works now. And this is not to say that there are not many wonderful mental health care professionals out there who are trying to change things. There definitely are. And they see problems within the system where you have very little proactive care and you know, people are getting treated like she's getting treated. Doctors aren't looking you in the eye or asking you questions. And, you know, this is kind of what
comes Sarah Goldfarbing, the Sarah Goldfarbing definitely still happens today in mass. It is.
Oh, yeah.
It is not good.
Yeah.
Also kind of something else I want to, talk about. I've heard, I've basically heard from women's accounts basically that they're essentially often treated as, you know, the women don't know what they're doing, just kind of ignore them.
So this is actually a conversation that I have with people in my friend group pretty frequently because it keeps coming up in our lives. And I'll say this. Yes, all of us have had negative experiences in the healthcare system, which have often been framed in a sort of like, well, you know, like she doesn't really know what she's talking about type of capacity. What I think, though, has been most disturbing to me is that the way that that impacts people is different based on other identity factors. So, for people who identify as women in the healthcare system, how you get treated is really determined on a bunch of different factors that include your race, your class, your religion, your language group, your sexual orientation. Your age is a huge one. And, you know, I've had interactions with doctors in the past year where I've had to tell them, you know, like, I'm having this symptom. And they're like, no, you're not. You're not having that. That's not a side effect. And I was like, yes, it is. And I'm having it. And so I just had to get up in their face about it and let them know that, you know, like, this is real. And I'm fine. I'm fine. I'm on a new medication and I'm going to be okay. But for my friends who are women of color and seniors, it's different. It's more of a life and death situation, and I just find that so profoundly disturbing. The stories that they have told me over the past two, three years, really, about, you know, having doctors or nurses or other medical staff who are really condescending to them, who wouldn't even explain what they had been diagnosed with, who, you know, like, were just kind of, like, rude to them in these different ways, but in ways that were really not great. Like, you need to know what your medication does and what it interacts with and stuff, especially if you are an older person. That's really, really important. And a lot of the stuff that happens to women in these two groups is, you know, it just places them in this very precarious place with their health, and it's just awful. And I hope it gets fixed. But it's going to take people talking about it to get it fixed. And that's oddly why I actually am so thankful for this movie, you know, despite it being flawed and kind of full of shock and awe drama. It's weirdly a very important intervention into U.S. film and conversations about mental health and senior care in the United States. So it's doing some good work.
Yeah. And I think last among our main characters is Jennifer Connelly as Marion. So first of all, great job standing at the end of a pier again. That's kind of her thing. Jokes aside, she is haunted in this film, and it's very compelling. And one of the things I don't like about this film, that unfortunately we can't really escape from, because, you know, it does affect us, is kind of this conflation between beauty and deservingness of, you know, humanity as attractiveness. Because, like, a phrase that comes to mind that I really hate is, you know, too beautiful for porn.
Yeah.
And there is, that is absolutely a, I think, you know, not social dynamic, but an artistic aesthetic that is very much conscious in this film and is very much being played with. Because, you know, we will definitely come back to kind of the morality and the shifting mores and norms and attitudes towards sex work. And also, straight up, putting this out there at the front of this discussion, this is coercive sex work, this is not cool, we're not into this. No.
Yeah.
But no. We will
Oh, this is...
We will come back.
Unambiguously coercive sex work.
Yes. So, but I do find, I think, that the film does criminalize it, I think. In that way. And that's something I'm kind of uncomfortable with. And this is one of those things, this is why this, I think, stays an A and not an A-plus film, is because I think there are added... Not necessarily the... Beyond just the filmic techniques... is there are attitudes in this film that have aged poorly. And it's not... I won't say that they're faultless for having these attitudes back when this was made. But the faults were much smaller back then. So it goes from like a little thing that kind of bugs you to like, yeah, we actually have a major problem with this. And like that's something I think that... keeps me from saying this is a film everyone should see, and this is a film that should be influential and a big part of kind of the film canon, is because of attitudes like this, where like the film calls her a whore, basically.
Yeah, it definitely does. I think, too, one of the things that I was having trouble grasping in this film was whether it's mocking some of its female characters or whether it's not. So, like, Ellen Burstyn's character, Sarah, I mean, the things that happen to her in the end, she's wearing clownish makeup. She has, you know, three separate personalities that we see in that scene. The clown, herself, and her TV self. And mocking her for these sorts of societal norms that she's been socialized into would feel very callous to me. And so I wanted to know, did you guys see that as mocking, or did you see that as something else?
I think the movie is definitely mocking her when she starts having the hallucinations about the refrigerator and about the TV, and eventually about the TV show itself, when she pops out of the TV along with the along with Tappy and start to mock her home. I think it's mocking her then, but when it gets to the point where she runs out of her home and starts babbling to this essentially random woman at the TV station about being on TV, that's when it stops mocking her. And it does mock her before then. I definitely say that the movie does sort of mock her before then, but after, you know, after completely mentally breaking, it just stops. And it just shows you this horrible thing.
So I'm having a thought about this, in that this film both does and does not believe in systems. Because
that was actually my thing.
Yeah, because ultimately this film, I think, is very sympathetic to the plights of its characters, and it is pornographically interested in showing us their misery. And, you know, that is where most of this movie is mined from. But that being said, while this movie is a tragedy and we are meant to sympathize with these characters, I cannot help but feel that each of them is portrayed as having made a mistake that is a conscious choice. It's kind of, you know, a libertarian bootstrap thing where it's like, no, if you had just been honest, no, if you hadn't taken that hit. And it's showing the collapse of these people's lives. And for Sarah Goldfarb, for Ellen Burstyn's character, that point, I think, is probably a crueler jab than for the others. It's you want to be on TV, is you're a stupid old lady who's obsessed with your game shows. And that's kind of her spiraling point to addiction. It's not sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's sex, drugs, and Jerry Springer.
Because one of the things that interested me about her character, which, Doc, I think you've kind of led me into weirdly, is the script gives us an indication that Aronofsky understands something is happening with her. She when asked why she doesn't turn her son in, she says, "He's all I have." And so we get this feeling that this is a woman who has very much centered herself in, you know, the sort of like American dream of the cis-hetero nuclear family and the kids and, you know, but I'm having thoughts about like, okay, is that the original sin that this film is kind of punishing her for? I don't know. Kind of feels like it a little bit, but I'm not sure.
Yes. So, interesting fact, I did not know this until just now. But this was based on a novel, and this novel was written in 1978.
Yep. Okay.
Published by them.
That explains the 70s vibe.
It's also published by Playboy Press, so that explains a little bit more.
Okay. Yeah.
Huh.
So,
I think the movie about Sarah's original sin. I think the movie has pointed that to the fact she cares so much about this game show. That just seems to be her. That's to me, rather. That seems to be her original sin that the movie is pointing towards. That.
Well, but what underlies that, though, is her addiction to dieting, right? It's her need to return to this original form that is this nostalgic memory of her youth when her husband was still alive. So it's a nostalgic return to that nuclear family idea that she cannot
I
have.
I think the way I describe her original sin, and I just want to put this out there that I hate the concept of original sin, not just in the Catholic way.
I do too, because it's
a useful concept to discuss in film criticism and in literary terms, but I think it's not a healthy attitude to look at people with. But her original sin isn't caring about the TV. Her original sin is being old. And especially in the late 90s, before, you know, Facebook is social connected, it's being old and isolated and having, I guess, not raised a good son and not be having a family that cares for her is, like, her original sin is not, I think, anything she's done, but just who she is in society. So I want to start going into some deep cuts, because it's difficult to talk about this film on a technical level, because kind of everything is doing something. So I have some notes here, and of the deeper stuff, like the kind of general themes that are going on, let's have a look-see. I have mirrors and the self, the predatory dynamic of the world, a hollowness to materialism, isolation in a pre-information era, drugs tamping down humanity. Oh, this isn't a deep cut, but this is just something I noticed that I think is a brilliant detail. Sarah stops turning on the lights in her apartment. That's not really going anywhere besides to say that's fucked up and that's really sad and that's a beautiful touch. And then the morality of sex work, a transactional model of the universe, and sex as consumption and domination. So those are my notes. That's the kind of shit I want to talk about here. But I want to start with mirrors and the self, because we were talking about Sarah Goldfarb a lot. And that's actually not where I wrote down this point. I wrote down this point looking at Tyrone looking into the mirror. But this is, in many ways, I think the follies of these characters, and I'm putting big air quotes on theirs because I think when we look at kind of these models of blame, they kind of exist on a spectrum, because on one extreme you have, you know, this libertarian nonsense where it's like everything you do is your fault and you are not affected by your environment, your surroundings in any capacity. And so these people all deserve what they get. But at the other end, at the other extreme, you have this is a deterministic universe and these people were always fated to be this way, so nothing matters. And we always want to find ourselves somewhere in the middle. But ultimately, how these people get where they are does, in most, if not all, instances come from I'd say a discordance between their perception of themselves and their idealized perception of themselves.
Yeah, I mean, this is a really messed up Lacanian mirror stage, right? So, like, it's the thing that happens to you after you're able to perceive yourself and to look at yourself in the mirror and be like, that's me. Well, now you have images to look at. You've got TV. You've got, you know, music videos. Now we have social media. And this creates a distorted and fractured sense of self. And I think that's definitely what it's exploring, right? So, like, not just the TV as a screen that you're looking into and consuming, but a mirror. Like, you treating that like a mirror and saying, I want to look like that. And, yeah. Man.
And yeah. For... Actually, what's kind of interesting is I do think we have one character without a mirror. And that is Marion. So, looking... Actually, no, she has a mirror scene. Wait.
Does she?
She does. In the okay. In the bathroom near the end when she, right before and maybe a little bit after Harry's call to her when he's when he's in the shot that makes him look like he already lost his arm. Where he's just curled up and vulnerable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, no, she actually does, but I'm not convinced that that doesn't mean she doesn't have it. That doesn't mean she has a mirror, and I'll explain what I'm going by with that in a second. But for... Okay, so let's go through the list. For Sarah, her mirror is the past. Her mirror is television. She's seeing a version of herself that was happy and is trying to reconstruct that. And that's where she slips into dieting addiction and trying to reclaim nostalgia. For Tyrone, he sees the past. He sees a kind of wholesome version of himself and his relationship with his mother. And he sees a dissatisfaction with kind of the realities of urban youthful life, of young adult life in a thing. And it's weird because... Like I said, we are of an age with these characters, and this film is 20 years old. But also, in a weird way, I would describe many of the characters in this film as being somewhat childlike and young. And I think that kind of reflects a difference in, I think, what is expected and what is the perceived and lived realities of people our age now versus then.
Yeah, and I think also there's some script differences, too, because originally these characters were supposed to be 14 to 16-year-old kids, but the studio refused to clear that with Aronofsky. They said that you wouldn't be able to play this in front of U.S. audiences, which I agree would probably not have happened.
I'm going to say the studio is completely in the right here.
Yeah, I think that's part of it, but like they're in a state of arrested development throughout this film. They're stuck in limbo, in a liminal space between childhood and adulthood, and it's a very uncomfortable space.
You know what? Weirdly, I think, well, first of all, I think that would make it an even more powerful Dare movie. But also, I think that would lead it to being a more obscure, more culty film. But I think it would also be more difficult to do. And I think that would actually be an easier film to make today because we have a crop of much stronger childhood actors. But also, like...
It is a film about addiction and kids, which is hard.
Yeah. So yeah. I actually had no idea that was a thing, that this originally was supposed to be a younger script. Because when I saw this as a teenager, I found the characters very relatable. And as an adult, I guess I'd call it a subconscious understanding of their arrested development. Because I was much more interested in the plight of Tyrone and of Sarah Goldfarb than I was in Harry and Marion. Moving back to mirrors. So Harry kind of sees success. I think, is what he's chasing, is freedom, because he is we have to remember where he begins in this movie, because it moves away from that, I think, fairly quickly. Is he's a junkie who's stealing from his own mother, who is enabling him through basically subsidizing his petty criminality. You know, she's buying back her TV from a pawn shop. That's basically the Trump casino daddy loan. You know, it's a loan without direct addressal of the problem.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
But he definitely feels some guilt about it. And one of the things that he chases is material success. And we don't necessarily see his vision of himself the way I think we do for other people. But we do see a bit of it through Sarah's vision of, you know, her successful son on TV wearing a suit. You know, he's engaged. He's going to get married in the summer. Yeah. But that is ultimately what he's chasing. And what he seeks is kind of independence. Marion, and I think this probably does speak to, I don't think it's fair. Like, okay. So I want to deal with something. And we've talked about this before, but I think it's important every time we discuss this topic to kind of clarify what we do. When we say that something is sexist or racist or transphobic or something, these are not binary statements. You are not either, you know, a great person or a Klan member. You are not either a good person or a misogynist. These things exist along a spectrum all the way from pure, which basically doesn't exist, to, you know, mild or benign or, you know, very subtle forms of these isms to outright hatefulness. So what I would say, when I say that this film, I think, is very sexist, I am not necessarily I am condemning it to a certain degree, but also this is an artistic product of its time, and also there are biases and it has to go through the Hollywood system. There's a lot going on. But ultimately, I think that this film, while sympathetic towards its female characters, is made by a man and does have some assumptions in the writing of it. The reason I bring this up is, you know, I think Sarah Goldfarb is an excellent character, and Marion Silver is in some ways not, because what she ultimately ends up doing is going hollow, is she becomes a whore. Her humanity is subsumed by sex work and by drug addiction. So in a way, I think she is probably the worst. So in a way, she kind of doesn't have a self, except that, you know, I want to be a fashion designer, but really that's not important to this film.
I think Marion's thing is that she just wants to escape, because she mentions a lot about like being cut off from her parents, or wanting to be cut off, or like wanting to like do her thing, or even just leaning on Harry for him to get the drugs to start selling again, and etc. She just doesn't know what she wants, and she wants to escape. Also, while we're on the topic of Marion, wow, that shrink is he's quite something.
He's a fucking asshole is what he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think there's a couple scenes that tell us about some of Marion's motivations in the film. So at the beginning of the film, like you said, Arthur, we're told that her family comes from money, but she tells us that this is not satisfying for her, that she's looking for something else. And when asked if she wants to start up her own business, she says, "No, Harry, that would take me away from you." So her, I guess we'll say her desire is kind of fixed on Harry as much as it is on the drugs that they do together. And that's kind of her motivation. As much as it is the drugs that they do together.
Yeah. In many ways, I feel like her character is written as somewhat of a hedonist.
Yeah, definitely.
And so going back to my thoughts on the fact that she has a mirror scene, and that she doesn't have, I guess, a mirror and a self in this film, is she doesn't seem to actually have an actualized or idealized self that she is pursuing. Is she's kind of a creature of habit and instinct, and
hunger. And so when she's looking in the mirror, it's very dead-eyed, it's very tragic, and I feel like the message we get from there is she looks in the mirror and she sees nothing. Agree, disagree?
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Yeah. That makes a ton of sense, because then she... Doesn't she take something in that scene as well? And then all of a sudden, like, there's more movement, her eyes become more open and stuff.
Essentially, in that scene, she's trying to...
She needs something to fill the emptiness.
In that scene, she's just trying to vent her frustrations, and especially with that bottle she downs, she's trying to find something to get high and to, like, stop feeling these things. Or at least channel the feelings in a different direction. She can't handle, like... She can't handle her emotions, basically, and she's just looking for the fix. Harry says his mom's fix is the TV. Marion's fix is not being Marion, or not thinking about being Marion.
Yeah.
Or at least that's how I see it.
You can actually, I think there's a little bit of a spectrum that we see her slide down, because there, I think there's more of a person at the beginning of the film. There's, like, there's that whole, you know, misspent youth going on rooftops, tripping alarms for fun shit going on. But also, one thing that kind of disappears over the course of the film are these intrusive thoughts, which I think are portrayed fantastically, by the way. The whole, like, the curiosity about the cop's gun. Like, that's a thought a lot of people have had, is seeing an object and knowing that it's within reach and knowing the absolutely dire consequences of it. And I actually think I love that that scene is so unrealistic, because Harry has the privilege, you know, he's a white boy in New York, as opposed to if Tyrone had that image, like, he would be shot by the cop instantly. Whereas, you know, Harry's strung out and he's can be like, he's got a gun. We could play keep away with him, you know? But at the beginning of the film, her intrusive thought is, I hate this man. I want to stab him in the hand and call him a fuckface. And it's like, she doesn't seem to like that about herself. That seems to scare her. And that pretty much gets subsumed away by the drugs and the haze.
I think that fork stabbing thing actually just happens before he, like, proposes having sex. Like, that's not an early part of the film.
Oh, wait, was it?
Yes, it's most of the way. It's
yeah.
most
Sorry,
of the way
no, yeah. yeah, no, because there are two versions of that scene. Sorry, no, you guys are right. I'm conflating things over time.
But I think that actually says something about this film. Like, that is easy to do, one. And two, that's how memory actually works. That's one of the cool things about this film, is that it rewrites over some of the things that we've seen a tiny bit. And it makes it hard to remember details from the film because it's structured so differently than what we're used to.
Yeah. And I mean, this is
one of the things I like about it.
I don't want to say it's the first, but it's one of, at least for me in my personal experience of, you know, art house cinema, is this is one of the earliest big art house movies that I was exposed to.
Okay.
And I'm not sure that I would necessarily call it art house. I think it's become mainstream, but at the time I wouldn't hesitate as much to describe it as such back in the day. What do you guys think? Is this art house?
Not.
Yeah, I think that kind of makes sense.
No, I don't really know what art house means, so I can't really give a good answer.
You know, for like artsy fartsy people who like drink wine and cheese on their yacht while they're going to the Toronto Film Festival or something.
Like, they drink cheese?
Or eat cheese.
You ever hear a fondue,
Arthur? Hey, do you know
Arthur?
What the rich people are doing these days? Drinking cheese.
Ever hear a what now, Sil? Ever hear a what now, Doc?
Ever hear a fondue?
That is blazing hot cheese. You do not drink that.
Yeah, don't drink hot cheese.
Well, you gotta filter it and inject it first. Okay, moving on.
You're not shooting up with fondue.
Well, you're not. There's none for you. Got this shit straight from Florida.
Florida fondue. That's horrifying.
Doc, horrifying. Doc, please make sure your arm is okay. We don't want to have your arm chopped off.
Hey, as we have learned, cheese makes you immortal. There's our topical reference. Way to date ourselves. It's fucking September 2018, motherfuckers. By the way, Florida Fondue is the name of my ska project.
That's just amazing.
Florida Fondue is actually the name of my YouTube cooking channel.
Okay, well, we're going to have to fight about that later. So one thing I want to talk about also, and Annie, I definitely want your input on this, because this is something that has been, I think, boiling over in progressive and leftist circles for a couple of years now, is changing attitudes and understandings and cultural norms and perception about sex work and the perceived immorality thereof. And while Marion is definitely she's being exploited. She is being part of exploitative and coercive sex work in this film. That's kind of unambiguous about it. But ultimately, I feel like this film still condemns sex work by its very nature of being sex work. And I kind of wanted to get your take on that, as a woman. Because, like, yes, sex work exists for other people as well, but is mainly seen as kind of an anti-feminist argument against it.
So the way that Marion's story is presented almost mirrors exactly the storyline of the fallen woman from Victorian novels. And it's deeply ironic because I think Aronofsky wants us to think that he has created something really new, like a new and fresh take on stories about addiction, but he really hasn't with regards to her story. Her story is so heavily reliant on tropes of white women's sex workers that you could do a whole dissertation on it. It's insane. So her story is not unlike that of Fanny Hill, which is a novel from the 18th century in Britain. Fanny is this little innocent young woman. She ends up doing some sex work, and she is brought into the world of sex workers and corrupted therein. She becomes addicted to gin, and she dies from it. And so this connection of sex work and addiction has been around for a very, very long time. The story is slightly reversed in Aronofsky's movie, but you can find that in pretty much any Victorian novel that you could pick up off of a shelf, though. Her transition from, you know, innocent but bohemian to a sex worker, or to be truthful, this movie sees her as a whore. That's really how she's painted in that last scene, and that's just so deeply disturbing to me. Her transition is marked by her wearing of makeup. It's marked by her wearing a smoky eye and a red lip, which for, I'd say, about at least 300 years have been a makeup look that's classically been used to signify what sex workers would wear to do sex work. So the idea of makeup itself has been associated with prostitution, the idea of the whore, the idea of making a mask for your face, something to hide under, that sort of idea. And that gets carried through in the film. I think one of the most disturbing scenes for me, though, was the scene in which Harry writes down the number for that guy that she's going to go and see so she can do some sex work and get some cash. And, or I think it's drugs. He writes down the number on the back of a photograph of Harry and Marion. And I'm not sure that Aronofsky is setting those things up to critique them. It seems more like he's setting them up to present those as the only two legitimate choices for Marion. And that's real disturbing.
Yeah, I mean, directly, it juxtaposes it in such a way as to present it as a binary choice. Is this kind of wholesome, you know, Instagram filter monogamy or being a whore? And it's it's interesting because Harry kind of pushes her into it. You know, he gets the number. He's like, you know, if you, and he's bullying her and he's being abusive towards her in this particular instance. But still, like, the way it plays out is still, even though he put the gun in her hand and, you know, yelled at her to pull the trigger, it's still her fault.
Mm-hmm.
In the eyes of the film.
So there's this scene where Marion goes over to exchange a blowjob for drugs at this man named Big Tim's house. So as she's about to go down on Big Tim, we hear a theme that sounds somewhat like the Jaws theme or like something from Psycho. And it's painfully clear to the audience that Aronofsky wants us to perceive her going down on this black man as the ultimate act of self-degradation that she's done so far. It's a way of sonically keying in us into this idea of sex work as self-degradation, as self-destruction. And, you know, like, there's also that added element to it of the fact that Big Tim is presented as a kind of pimp archetype, and there are associations there with hypermasculinity and hyperphallic performance that we could get into. I'm sure someone's written on that. But, you know, it's just a scene where Aronofsky, who is claiming to have been doing all this new stuff throughout this film, is heavily reliant on old, tired stereotypes, and really on stereotypes that not only degrade women, but also present black men as monstrous. And that's just gross and awful.
Yeah. So that is one thought I had about this film that I'm really kind of conflicted about, because weirdly enough, Marion, among all our main characters, ends up in the best place, quote unquote, where she still has her freedom. And yes, she is in this kind of coercive arrangement. She's still addicted. And she's like, for her, like, a more permanent, and I guess what you call a more final hell, is still more on the horizon than it is here right now. But her personal hell and her, you know, punishment for her drugs and her lifestyle of sin, so to speak, is itself sex work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really fucked up. And this in this film, like, we don't have examples of non-coercive sex work, really. So it's kind of fucked up. I really hate that about this film, because it is portrayed as being a desperate action from the mind of a drug-addled and, you know, withdrawing person.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who is not in their right mind. So, in that way, there is some sympathy for the circumstance that leads to it, but I don't think there's any sympathy for the action itself.
Mm, no.
Is from the very moment she opens the door and Big Tim smiles at her, like, not even before that, when she makes the phone call, he laughs at her.
Yeah.
It's just, it's fucked up, and I've got a lot of really complicated feelings about it. And, like, that's kind of, because also, and I think this is something where I have a genuine problem with this film, is the ass-to-ass scene. Because it's looking at it to kind of say, look at this kind of disgusting, degenerate hell into which she has descended. But at the same time, it's using all the aesthetics of that sleaze. It's shooting a good porno scene, you know? It's having its cake and eating too. It's condemning it while also indulging in it.
Which has, I think, been the major criticism of Aronofsky's work in general. And I think that's gotten even more pronounced in some of his later films. Because that's, I think my biggest issue with this film is that it doesn't really acknowledge the systems that are in place that put these people where they were fully. Like, it does it partially at some points and then not so much at others. And then it kind of invites the audience to be horrified, but to somehow bask in the spectacle of their fall from grace. And yeah.
Actually, one little interesting thing about systems in this movie, So something I didn't pick up on when I first viewed this film, because I can tell you I've watched this film exactly twice in my life.
Yeah.
Because I watched it the first time, and then I never watched it again, and then I watched it for the podcast. So thanks, Arthur.
No problem.
But the other thing about this, the thing I picked up that I was oblivious to the first time, and also I didn't live in America at the time, I hadn't for many years, so is, first of all, like, it's not actually explained why, it's not explained exactly why Harry goes to jail. So it's not explained why. It's presumed that, oh, hey, you're a junkie, you gotta go to jail. And we can talk about recidivism and, you know, drug behavior, you know, drug help versus drug criminalization at a later time. Or not even really, I think it's in the scope of this film. But for one thing I realize is that Tyrone goes to jail because of a parole violation. And that is, I think, part of a weird paradox of this film is it seems to understand systems and disregard them entirely for the most part, except where it's convenient. Because, you know, there's the school-to-prison pipeline, there's stuff, and then, you know, you've got this kind of pharma-pushing, opioid crisis-esque, you know, speed prescription for Sarah. And it understands systems, but it kind of indulges in that only to a point to get where it wants to go, and then it can say, ha-ha, look at these people.
Yeah, and it offers no real, like, it doesn't offer us anything beyond the spectacle of their disgrace, I guess, or the spectacle. In some cases it is disgrace, but in other cases it's just the mire of their despond, I guess. And it doesn't really offer as much bond that. I don't know what to do.
So one thing I would like to say is this movie is very don't do this, but it also doesn't offer a do this instead.
Yeah. I think that's maybe what I'm picking up on. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why this has such a dare quality to it, is there is no, I don't want to say moral, but there is no satisfying end to a narrative arc. It's just, look at what happens to these people. That's why it feels like punishment. That's why it feels like hell, is it feels like a judgment upon these characters because there is no hopeful resolution. It is just, everything is bad forever.
Except for Tyrone, who possibly gets better.
Well, I mean, here's the thing. Tyrone is a felon. Like, life is going to be hard for him no matter what. Even if you want to argue that, you know, he is the most responsible of them, he is the least addicted of them, and that he could get out and make something out of his life, he is going to face struggle, and his self-actualization and his understanding of himself is being challenged and is being subjected to a lot of stress at the end of the film. One thing I find interesting is that the aesthetics of his time in prison are actually very strange, because they remind me of, and I could be citing the wrong experimental film here, but like there's a lot of stuff from the 70s and 60s, stuff like Dog Star Man, where everything's very sped up and kind of, you know, whiny and tapey. Like, that scene, and when the camera, actually, I love that scene where he and Harry are shouting about Harry's arm from the prison cell, about how he needs help, and every time they shout, the film tracks wrong. I love that. That is such a great effect.
The film quivers.
But
that's what it does. It's very disconcerting. Actually, the entire, like, back third of the film is very disconcerting in general.
Absolutely. So, there is a perception, I think, that time ceases to exist for him, and ultimately, that is one thing that is a huge problem with the carceral state, is you end up in this situation where people will lose years of their life, and even if they had none of the other disadvantages of, you know, prison life and, you know, felony arrest records, problems with employment, problems with gangs, problems with association, and that losing time
loses your ability to build a base for yourself, whether we're going with, like, you know, building a fucking 401k or, you know, advancing and stuff. It's like your life is arrested, literally arrested, and continuing, even if you could just continue instead of starting from scratch, is you are on a back foot for the rest of your life. So, like, there is no...
Oh, that scene that you all were referencing where it kind of looks like the people behind Tyrone are sped up and he's just staring out through the bars, that reminded me so much of... I did a whole bunch of readings last year on artists and mass incarceration, because I was just interested in, you know, like, what imprisoned artists do while they're in prison and how they're making their work. And that was one of the key things that they said, was that time doesn't exist, or it's measured differently. It's measured between the phone calls you receive, or, you know, the conversations that you have, or between mealtimes. And it, time just is made differently. And I don't think this film goes into that very deeply, but that sense of alienation that he has in that scene definitely resonated with me when I was thinking about that.
Ultimately, I feel like this film is judgmental. And that's kind of...
not great?
Its biggest problem is that this is not, I think none of this is the lived experience of Darren Aronofsky. And I think that is... and I think in that way... you mentioned it feels very touristy, especially in the life of, you know, urban drug culture and in this idea. So I think it's kind of telling that this is, you know, from a Playboy published novel, because that's the, it feels somewhat exploitative. It feels somewhat sleazy. And that's the ultimate problem with it. But I still think that there is a, there's an aspect of, there's something true in this. There's something, I don't like true as the word, exact word for it, but there's something relatable and there's something humanistic at the core of it that I think is kind of raw and showed through, and is why this film is as widespread and as powerful as it is. And I wish we had a little bit more of that. So I think that's kind of my final thoughts. And I think, sorry, the other thought is that, like, it's judgmental, and it also, it reveals some biases that I'm very uncomfortable with, particularly this idea of sex as consumption. So yeah, so the last segment I want to conclude on, and this is something new that we're doing, is I want to kind of address the director. And I choose the director for a couple of reasons. Is, yes, film is a collaborative process. Yes, editors are important. Yes, actors are performance. But pretty much everyone else in a film has a scope to their contribution. A director is still kind of the name attached to the product, to the project, and is supposed to be. There's a lot of complicated things going on with modern studio films and reassigning directors and rewriting footage and reshoots and all that. But in kind of classical film theory, the director is the auteur, and even if they are not an auteur, they are ultimately responsible for constructing the film. So I think talking directly to them and saying, kind of responding, I guess, to the statement they make with their film is something that I kind of want to explore and try to do going forwards. So, like, in the pithiest, smallest bit that you could, what would you say to Aronofsky about this film? Let's start with you, Arthur.
Dear Darren...
no pressure.
Dear Darren Aronofsky, this movie would be a lot better if you just faced left and kept going left. Just dive straight into leftist theory. Really get your face into it. Also, that final scene of Marion and the like dozens of rich dudes just throwing money, It's very good, but also very not. You're channeling something there, and I think you should see a therapist about it. Maybe. Possibly. That's sincerely Arthur Lay.
Annie?
Let's see. Well, Mr. Aronofsky. This one is pretty crazy. There were some things that I found in this film that deeply resonated with me and that I appreciated immensely. And I think the aesthetic eye that you and your DP have in this film is pretty incredible. I think there were issues with the way that you set up the world in the script and the fact that there's not an acknowledgement of how things seem to work for these people at times, and at other times there is. But I think overall this project is a very important project that you've done, and yeah, I probably won't watch it again ever. Or at least not for a while. How about you, Doc?
Alright. So, Aronofsky, buddy. I'm glad that there was substance to this film, because I was really afraid that there wouldn't be. I want you to go back to making movies like this, because your recent stuff has been not clever for what it is, but for what it pretends to be. And that hasn't been great for me. But there's a humanistic core to this film that I'd like to see you get back to. And this was, despite all our complaints, despite our problems, a great film. And I think you could absolutely improve on it. You could absolutely do more like this and expand kind of the humanistic scope that makes this film great. It's not the misery porn that we love about this. It is absolutely not. And I think you might have missed a bit on the mark on why that was successful. But maybe try again, because I think you have the resources, and I think that you are a good filmmaker and that you could make great films again. This has been The Movie Morgue, your premier movie autopsy podcast. I'm your host, Silvio Emery. You guys can follow me on Twitter and twitch.tv at DoubleDocMD.
And I have been your co-host. I'm Annie Neller. And as always, you all can find me on at Lights and Music. Oh, on Instagram
and Twitter. Arthur Lay, where can people find you and your work?
Hi, I'm Arthur Lay. And I refuse to tell you all my Twitter. That's not happening. But you can find me on the Movie Morgue Discord, where I always constantly lurk and make terrible posts. Just awful.
Absolutely. Speaking of the Discord, we have a Discord. Link is in the description. We have a Twitter at MovieMorgCast. Please feel free to follow there. Please remember to like, comment, subscribe, and definitely review us on iTunes. That helps a lot. But more than anything, we ask you to keep listening if this is something that you enjoy, and to please tell your friends about it. You know, use us as cite us in arguments, or you know, tell people how fucking wrong we are. Either way, word of mouth is the only way we're ever really going to grow. And we thank each and every one of you, friends, patrons, and family, make all this possible. Our Patreon is patreon.com/doubledocmd, and you guys make all this possible. Thank you, each and every one of you. We love you.
Goodbye, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.